Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 136, featuring two good friends of ours, Lon. Who are they?
Mark Petit,
yeah.
And Ken Pimentel.
Yes, and who do they work for?
Our friends over at Epic.
Our friends at Epic, which was a really this was a big thing that happened at SIGGRAPH for us. It was really kind of cool. So tell them a little bit what happened. Just get a little backstory there.
Yeah, I mean, it was maybe the first official debut since Vlado kind of gave a peek look at this at EUE.
Yeah.
But Vlado was up on stage at the Epic user event downtown LA,
mm-hmm.
and got to unveil V-Ray for Unreal for
right.
the first time, which was very cool to see. And I also sort of loved Vlado's end moment where he's like making real time a little bit more real.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have sort of questioned why, thinking that, Unreal is a competitor to V-Ray, but that's we're finding quite the opposite. Actually, they complement each other really well. There's a lot of things that make sense when you put a ray tracer inside of a real-time engine.
Yeah, and I think as more and more people, look to Unreal or other game engines as a platform that they want to actually build,
mm-hmm.
Their assets into, it just makes great sense to be able to have both of those follow a single pipeline and get either result out of it instead of having to backtrack and do it separately or whatever. So hopefully we can remove a lot of the pain points of getting assets into it and rendering it with V-Ray at any time.
Sure.
So I think it's gonna be awesome.
I think it is as well. Obviously, I think what's also interesting is the enormous amount of different industries that have approached us about this problem. And actually, ironically, hardly any of them are games, right? They're all non-games, which is specifically the group that Mark and Ken are involved with. They're part of what they call the enterprise group, right?
Yeah, so they're working with enterprise customers around the world. And that could be, automotive, it could be architecture, it could be product design,
right,
et cetera. And that's where they really see, this major need for what they're doing with the enterprise level, stuff at Epic, as mm-hmm. well as where V-Ray for Unreal would be a good fit.
Yeah, and these guys are veteran in that field, on that subject, right? They've been around, we've known them for years.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I sort of tease them, like, getting the band back together because,
right.
So many of the guys that worked together in Montreal or at Autodesk or had been part of the 3ds Max team.
Right.
It's nice to see some familiar faces and
yeah,
doing some cool stuff.
So it was a really good podcast with them. It was a lot of fun to do that. But we should actually mention that this comes out on Monday, and then on Thursday, you and I are going to be in Vienna.
In Vienna, that's right.
That's right. So what are we doing in Vienna?
Sound of Music.
Sound of Music.
We're just frolicking through the hillsides.
There'll be some sweet, sweet music in Vienna. It's true. But we're going to be attending D2, which is a really cool conference out there. I think it's like the third year maybe second or third year. I'm not sure which year. This is my first year for sure. Yours too, right?
Yep, it was my first time.
Yeah, and so it's going to be a lot of fun. It's a ArcViz-centric conference. A lot of really great people will be there. A lot of familiar friends will be there. We are going to be doing some really cool stuff. So pay attention to some of the announcements we have coming out over there. It'll be pretty awesome. I'm very excited about that. So we're doing a lot of awesome things. This company is going places, Lon. Very happy to be working here and with among all these amazing announcements we've been making. So pay attention to that. And is there any other things that we should be announcing soon? I guess there's a few platforms coming out soon, so pay attention. Obviously, you know where to follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and Instagram, and all those other platforms. Of course, you can always just check out things on Labs if you want to do that. And make sure also to follow us at CG Garage Podcast, all one word, on Facebook. So that's the other place to follow us. All right, thanks a lot, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, You need to make sure everything has for now.
Tu sais que j'arrive à parler français, Marc.
Oh, you speak French.
C'est pour ça que je te dis, si tu entends du français, c'est normal.
Excellent. All right. Well, we've already started recording, and I always do the intros before that, so we're going to just jump right into this. I think this is really awesome that we're all here, and then we're at SIGGRAPH and talking about some really, really interesting ideas, because I think what you guys are doing and what we're doing is we're sort of almost asking the world, it's like, we think this is pretty cool. What do you guys think? You know what I mean? So tell me a little bit about this new division, or not so new anymore, but that you guys have made at Epic, and what are the mm-hmm. efforts that you guys are putting in here?
Sure. So you have to roll back the clock a few years back when Epic decided, you know, to make Unreal Engine 4 widely available.
Right. So what was that decision? What led to that decision?
Well, you know, I read some interview of Tim Sweeney back in 1996 where he was predicting that this technology would be used in film mm-hmm. if only it had like 100,000 time performance improvement.
Right.
We almost got the 100,000 time performance improvement, right. By the way. If you remember what the graphics card was in 1996?
Uh-huh.
VGA mm-hmm. and stuff. So Tim has always had that in him, and they had seen with UE3. You know, remember the Dallas Stadium, mm-hmm. Cowboy Stadium was made with Unreal 3.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when Unreal 4 came out, you know, and they said, look, let's make it widely available. You know, we'll catch royalties from the games guys and, mm-hmm. you know, we'll let the other guys experiment with it.
Right.
And then a few years later, 3 million users... indication of a lot of usage in architecture in many places, and then they decided it was time, and a lot of pull from the customers to have to have support and to have help and to see focus, particularly in right. automotive, in architecture, and that's why Ken and I come in, because you know last year Epic decided to be serious and try to start supporting this customer, turn this into a business,
right.
And while keeping, you know, the openness, software remains free, you know.
Sure.
And so that's what happened, and that's what's been doing the past 9 months, is building an organization to support the people who deploy Unreal Engine outside of games and make sure they're successful.
Right.
And starting to understand, you know, how we can help them and how we can customize the offering for them, which we have shown at SIGGRAPH this year.
Yeah, no, it's really, I remember when back in my previous life as an architect, and I was working on some you know, visualization stuff, and we really wanted an idea of licensing a game engine, and you know, go back to 1996 or when I was, or 1999 or so, whatever it was, it cost $500,000 to license a game engine. Right. And that's because you were going to make that money back when you made the actual game. But for an architect, it's like, why would I pay $500,000 to license a game engine? It was ridiculous. So now the fact that it's gone from that to free. Just free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's ask, how do you make money on this if it's free? what is your business?
So the culture at Epic is, you know, is that we don't have to make money from everybody.
Okay.
So we're perfectly comfortable with people, you know, particularly smaller businesses, you know, not taking money from them.
Okay.
So in enterprise, you know, the what we're doing now is the people who want support, you know, who want some level of customization, who want a relationship, they come to us and we get them a custom deal. Let's take us of a lot of car manufacturers, for example.
Got it.
But in architecture, you know, it's a lot of people use it and it's free. It's fine. Maybe one day we'll think about having an offering dedicated to them. We see demands from these customers. Mm-hmm. They want more learning content. They want more support. They want, you know, more easy to deploy technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like me, like in architecture, visualization is not often paid for.
Right.
It's a cost. So there is a lot of sensitivity around that. So
yep.
It needs to be very straightforward. So so that's how, you know, that's how we think we're, you know, I don't think the technology is 100% ready for the market. Mm-hmm. We still need to work. To make it to a real a product that we could like really monetize. So I think we have some work to do. So we're very happy to take our time. That's what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
Very happy to take our time for monetization. We're very comfortable having a lot of people use it. you know, we're a very successful, the engine is a very successful business. We have so many people that actually want to pay and get support.
Right.
So we're doing well.
Well, I think, you know, and we'll talk a little bit about what our efforts are in this, but I think we're sort of in the same boat where we're just saying, we see that there's some kind of demand, some kind of thing that's happening here. But I think that all of us are sort of unclear as to how it would get used. But we're all jumping in feet first and saying, well, let's figure this out together and then let's all work on it and find some interesting thing. And it's been a really interesting idea. What do you, Ken, what do you think some of the interesting use cases or ideas have come out of this?
I think this is really the dawning of a new age. And it's the age of experiencing design. For decades now, we've been using images to drive design, still imagery, right? Mm-hmm. That, if you talk to an architect, 90% of architects do still imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've unlocked this opportunity to experience, directly experience design. They've never really had this opportunity. Mm-hmm. If, you know, an image is worth 1,000 words, what's the value of experience?
Right.
And it's for them, their answer to this is, I don't know, but let's find out.
Right.
It's compelling. You know, I joined in October, and in November there was a survey run by CG Architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is. Unreal is the fourth most popular renderer. You know, and they didn't qualify whether you're using online or interactive, but it was just renderer.
Right.
And of course, V-Ray, of course, number one and number two.
Right.
No surprise.
Right.
But there we are in fourth.
Yeah.
And we had done nothing to enable that other than here's a free engine.
Right.
I think it speaks to people, you know, awakening to the value of interactive content.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they need V-Ray, they need the high precision, highly accurate renderings, but they also need to communicate their design intent, you know, to show their design.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want to interact with things. I mean, we're all coming from a... We're all growing into an area where you interact with things and you make things yours. You know,
sure.
We do this on our phones all the days,
right.
Customizing the content, you know, customizing what we watch on television and everything. So I think the way I interpret, you know, how we got there is the draw for, you know, the strong appetite for interactive content.
Right.
And attractive content as a gateway to VR and AR, of course, that's also one of the ultimate drivers.
I think what's interesting, because I've known you guys for years, but even before you were guys at Epic, and
absolutely.
You know, we're working on some of those things. So you guys are very familiar with the architecture community for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What I find is interesting about it is that most people don't... let's use VR as an example, right? A lot of people, when they're creating VR stuff, they're not necessarily thinking about the architecture community. They're thinking about the film industry or things of that nature, which I think is a shame. And I've discussed this on the podcast before. But you guys immediately saw as like architecture, right?
Can we tell you a secret?
Sure.
Because we have a big failed project.
Oh, yeah?
That
yes.
we did together that... You know, where we had identified the need, and it was a few years back, and we had built the right. We were convinced we're building the right thing.
We're going after the right problem, but we used the wrong engine
technology. We were really, and it was a project called Newport. We can mention it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may remember. It had a lot of traction. I mean, when we presented the concept, we failed to deliver because the technology on which this product was built was initially built for the manufacturing industry, and it didn't have the scalability, and you know, there was no point in it. It was not adequate.
Mm-hmm.
But Ken and I, we had already seen the appetite for interactive content,
right?
And for a quick setup, and we kind of knew, you know, we'd done a lot of analysis, and Ken had done a lot of customer interviews and stuff. So that's why, you know, when I arrive at Epic, and you know, it's two things that springs to my mind. We need a better pipeline.
Right.
Well, it's just like, let's stop the madness. You know, we need a better pipeline. And we know that, you know, there is pent up demand for interactive content out there, because we remember it from, it was 3 or 4 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the CG Architect survey comes out and like, oh my God, there's more than pent up demand. People are doing it.
Well, here's the thing, right? Because let's go back to the VR thing for a second. VR content and architecture is not like, I wonder if architecture will use VR. They have been using it for the last 4 years, yes, and selling this as a product, right?
Great.
So obviously, tools like Unreal are going to be in demand in this area, especially, mm-hmm, when you want 6 degrees of freedom. And that even includes things if you're going to do pre-rendered degrees of 6 degrees of freedom, like the guys at NoZone are doing, mm-hmm, or some of the other light field experiments. Those can still exist within an Unreal Engine because that can still drive, mm-hmm, how you are. I mean, it's really an interactive space that's a blank slate. You guys can put anything into it.
Mm-hmm.
So VR is a critical part of it, and architecture is making enormous amount of VR right now, mm-hmm, more than anyone and that I can think of is making that. Now, it's not getting as much press as the other ones.
Absolutely.
But they are making it every, mm-hmm, day. We were talking to the guys at ARX, which is a big ArcVis company out of Miami and Argentina and Spain, and they said that 40% of their income comes from VR content.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
And they're using Unreal as well, obviously, because, mm-hmm, some of that VR content's Unreal. Some of it, mm-hmm, some of it's just cube maps because, mm-hmm, you need to make those as well. But there's a lot of VR, and so that's what's kind of awesome about it.
Well, there's an ecosystem rapidly growing up around Unreal. It's avalanching. Basically, you know, I think you guys at Chaos, mm-hmm, kind of led the charge here with V-Ray for Unreal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that has opened a lot of people's eyes about the shift and where it's going. And
yeah,
you guys are kind of an endorser, you know, of this is the way to go, people.
Right.
You know, we're there. We're part of that leading charge. But, you know, our work with City Engine to get their data,
yeah,
into, and it's opening up people's ideas of what's possible. And
it's interesting because, and I'd love to hear what's your take on this, because a lot of people are very, when they get, some people are like, oh yeah, that's exactly what I need. I need V-Ray instead of Unreal. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are going, I don't understand. I thought,
because they're coming from Max or Maya, and they already had V-Ray probably.
Well, it was like, well, I thought, well, they're thinking like that Unreal is a competitor to...
It doesn't have to be.
No, exactly. But right, it's not at all. So,
right.
So what is your take on yeah, those people who are like, those things like, well, why would you use V-Ray if you're already using,
yes,
Unreal?
So still-based workflow is going, you know, printed image is not going away.
Mm-hmm.
Still imagery is not going away. Those,
right,
things need to be done with physically based rendering that's, you know, believable rendering. I think there's a gap between what physically based renderers do, like V-Ray, and what real-time engines do, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So we don't solve every problem, and we have to be careful setting expectations that we do.
Right.
Because we want to be clear with people. You know, there are things around glass. There's a lot of issues that we're not physically correct on.
Right.
So, and that's just a compromise to get performance, and that's why we're fast and, mm-hmm, V-Ray's not.
Right.
So, the still-based workflow, for sure, where that's going to exist, and that is a multi-layered, it's a photoshopping workflow. We're not at all interested in that. If you're going to be experiencing design, you're not going to really do it through a still image, and we want to stay focused on the experiencing design, the interactive component, building unique applications of the data.
Right.
You know, that's really the most interesting, not being a fast renderer. It's building, let's say, a way to look at the data in a whole new way. Maybe layer metadata on it, make it interactive. You click on something, something happens.
Right.
That's where we're going.
So it's almost fair to say that you're the great interactive renderer is a great byproduct of the products that you're going to be making, but you're interested in making products with everyone, right? You're interested in making interactive experiences.
Yes.
And almost turning it into a DCC application that would allow you to, yes, create all kinds of things, right?
And as a platform, I think a platform is really...
A platform.
What's different now? Well, we are a platform. We're not trying to deliver every possible vertical application that people need. Instead, we're saying, this, for the first time, you have a platform to develop anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
We're making it as easy as possible to build that. We're going to give you samples of things to build. Go forth and multiply.
Right.
And, you know, back to your comment, picture is worth a thousand words. I mean, when Vlado came on stage in our user group, and that video should be on YouTube mm-hmm, pretty soon.
Awesome.
Look at the picture. I mean, you can tell.
Right.
When you see the retro headlights of that motorbike, mm-hmm, and the level of realism that you get, you know,
yep.
from V-Ray inside Unreal next to the Unreal picture, you know, there was a world of a difference. And, you know, that gap may become a little bit smaller when the hardware becomes more capable.
Sure.
But, you know, I still believe that there will be a lot of rooms and a lot of, we will, the accuracy, the, you know, you guys do so many things that, that a deferred renderer doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why. And then there is this notion of, you know, I think Chaos Group and Epic Games, we're both very focused on customer needs.
Mm-hmm.
And we know when to listen to customers. And we kind of put this first. And I think that's why we always like working with you guys. And that's why, you know, we were very naturally, first thing we did is call Vlado, call you guys, discuss, mm-hmm. you know, acknowledge the needs, understand the difference, and have some very good conversation. And I think we came up with a solution that works fine, because look at this Harley Davidson demo we had on stage. You know, you mm-hmm. take CAD, you know, we take care of the pipeline, we aggregate it in Unreal.
Mm-hmm.
You can manipulate it in Unreal, experience your design, go collaborative and so on and so forth. And then boom, one click and you're in the world of V-Ray.
Mm-hmm.
That was a powerful, you know, that's a powerful demonstration of how two companies can line up great technology. Yes, there is some overlap, but, you know, we're capable of going over that.
Right.
And, you know, we're capable of delivering a super streamlined pipeline that has the two best renderers in the planet right now.
Yeah.
In all modesty.
Yeah, I just want to say, I think when the two top leaders in their respective fields get together,
mm-hmm.
magical things can happen. Like, we're collaborating, you know? Yeah, it could have been a head-to-head thing, but it's not. It's let's make this work best for the end user. Let's figure out the workflows. Let's direct users to use the best technology for their problem.
Yeah, I think it's I mean, Peter was sort of saying that we want to enable anyone who wants to visualize anything to give them the right tools to do that, right? And so we knew that when people from our industry, from, you know, our user groups are starting to look at using an Unreal, that doesn't mean they're moving away from V-Ray. It means Absolutely. That they continue. In fact, that was so clear. It's like, I want this for this reason, but I still need to do my rendering. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay. You know, and cars, let's use your Harley Davidson example, which was a great demo of that workflow that you can envision. You know, you take your CAD data that is very dense, very accurate, doesn't always look that great, right? And then you made it look really great in Unreal, and bam, it was beautiful. But when you're a car designer, you then need to go check that headlight, make sure that headlight is perfect, yeah, because that's like the eyes of the car, right? Mm-hmm. Or you need to check the reflection on the body of the mm-hmm. panel, and that's got to be ray traced in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Now, it'll look pretty good interactively, and it'll look great, and you can move around it, and you can open the doors, you can close the doors, and that's a level of interaction that, you know, that no one can really mm-hmm. do, but being able to go back and forth, I think.
Well, to verify, right?
To verify, yeah.
We let you explore the world, get that direct experience, mm-hmm. and then you might have a question like, let me just double check this.
Mm-hmm.
And we give, you know, V-Ray will give you that opportunity to get a physically based version of reality
mm-hmm.
and go, yes, okay, or no, you know, like, this is something we need to study more.
Right. What do you guys think are well, I won't get into that just yet. So, Have there been a reaction from some of your customers about some of this collaboration in terms of what this means and what has been some of the feedback that you've gotten?
I mean, it's overwhelmingly positive. I mean, people really really enjoy that, you know, we come together to bring them the solutions to the real problems,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we can go over. I want to also remind that, you know, game engine is much more than graphics.
Yeah.
You know, there's always the visual component, but, you know, there are so many subsystems in there, which starts to be important for experiencing design. You know, of course, animation.
Right.
But physics, you know, physics simulation, very accurate physics simulation, audio, 3D audio, and multi-user and all of that.
Well, there's a plethora of interactive tools.
Yeah. So there is there is more to a game engine than just the graphics portion. So mm-hmm. that's something that's definitely part of the equation. So back to the customer feedback, I think it's, you know, honestly, it's people love you, your customers love you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, they appreciated the fact that we come with two messages that were mattered to them. Say, we'll figure out the pipeline problems, because right now it's too hard to get data into the engine. So the mm-hmm. commitment through DataSmith of Epic to solve this problem was very much welcome. And then we will respect your existing investments, mm-hmm. the tools you like. You know, if you make creative decisions in Jira, you can carry them into Unreal. Mm-hmm. And then if you are into Unreal, you know, you're not a dead end, you can still experience your high quality renders into V-Ray. Mm-hmm. I think it was, you know, I think it's, this is what happens when you are sincerely responding to what customer needs. They love you to death.
Yeah. Well, what do you think are some of those challenges that we've, I mean, because it, Unreal really is built for, was, you know, initially built as a game engine, but what were some of the challenges or surprises that happened? They're like, oh, that's going to be a difficult problem to solve as you go in there. And how have we responded to some of those?
Well, I would say in the architectural space, there are far less challenges.
Sure.
Than in film.
Right.
And other workflows. So, you know, it was relatively...
I think that, you know, what one thing is that most enterprise customers are more than willing to go both throw hardware at it, a problem, mm-hmm. to get their end, to reach their end goal, which is not a kind of games profile. Mm-hmm. So we have to do things like support SLI, allow people to fully max out their hardware,
which is
a little different than in games because you won't really have that need.
In games, they sort of have to play to the lowest common denominator,
yes.
right?
Yeah. So that's one of the examples of some where we're kind of different than games in our needs.
Right.
And then certainly the engine was always known for fidelity. And so what we've been trying to do is push it even as hard and fast even further in that mm-hmm. Direction. Because that's really a major benefit that our customers are getting from it. And the games team, you know, sometimes they never thought they'd need to expose a parameter that would drop things down to 10 frames per second because who would use that?
Right.
Well, you know, of course, we know a lot of people that would trade off performance for quality.
Yes.
So we need to kind of review some of these things in the engine and say, let's allow these things to happen because... you know, if it's still predictable results, it's just a little slower, but you get better results. That's probably something that our customers will make the trade-off for.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of, why would you ever want that?
But, yeah. And there has been. So there's been an education process.
Yeah.
Both ways. And you know, enterprise will grow up inside of Epic and help influence those directions. You know, we were just starting.
Yeah. I'm starting to see, and I'm sure you guys have seen this as well. What's also interesting is obviously in the architecture is clearly an industry that's interested in, and so is automotive design that's interested in, or vehicular design. Let's just call it that. But another thing that's interesting in the film industry is there has obviously been some talk about, you know, in Rogue One how some of those final frames are rendered in Unreal, which is an interesting aspect as well. But what's more interesting to me is how a game engine can play a very interesting role in virtual production. Mm-hmm. And what are some of your thoughts about virtual production and how Unreal can sort of play a role there?
So virtual production is challenging because it's relatively young discipline and nobody wants to do the same thing. So it's... There's a few stages in the world, and everybody has a different view how things should be done. But there is no doubt that the quality graphics that we deliver now is helping make creative decisions earlier, which is the whole at the base of all of this, which is, you know, that's, you want to make creative decisions earlier,
right?
Because the earlier you make your creative decision, the cheaper it is.
Sure.
So it starts with previs. You know, we've seen the previous industry adopt Unreal 4 massively. We showed, you know, Planet Apes, Valerian,
and
all that stuff. It's quite interesting to see, you know, that pushing very far the ability to make creative decisions very early. I'm not saying they make lighting decisions yet, but they make a lot of, you know, creative story decisions on previous.
Sure.
Virtual production, then you add the layer that you are live on stage and you have to cater to a lot of different workflows because you have the camera guys, the light guys, the set dressing guys, mm-hmm. the mocap guys. So it has a layer of complexity. And so we support a lot of efforts in that space where, you know, it's a kind of a gigantic multi-user game where the user persona change from stage to stage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's clearly the way to go. And when you see We announced 417 here at the show. We have all of those compositing capabilities that we added, you know, to do the human race.
Yes.
You know, when you have live action, real-time composited. So this ability to seamlessly integrate live action and graphics, if we can do this on stage, you know, workflows, a simulcam workflows since Avatars from the work that Glenn Derry did in the field on all those movies like Real Steel and stuff. So we're getting there. But it's, you know, it's not a product approach yet. It's really, we're still in the early days, and it's every solution gets crafted different. It's a lot of development. I wish we were able to kind of agree upon some things so that we can actually reuse more.
I know.
Across.
I've been talking to. I have a lot of. I mean, I talked to Glenn as well, and Ben Grossman over at Magnopus.
Absolutely.
And those guys, and there's a lot of people that are sort of struggling with the virtual production thing, trying to figure out the right solution, because I think we're at a turning point now, and things are going to look really good in virtual production.
But we have one problem to fix.
What's
yet,
that?
Which, and it's actually it's the same. I kind of touch based on it when you talk about architecture, but particularly what we've seen in previous and also in virtual production, there's not a lot of money in budget for asset transformation.
Right.
So to make an asset real time viable, I mean that process, we absolutely need to automate it and reduce the cost, because that is what's screwing the entire system, because nobody wants to pay for that.
There are people who are paying for it. Back, you know, like if you look 2-3 years ago when architects were just starting to look at going into Unreal, they were actually paying companies to assetize their material to get into a real-time engine.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that was, you know, there was early adopters.
Still manual.
Because there probably were a moment where selling a VR experience was expensive. Now you have a de facto commoditization. So whether it's in architecture or in film, you know, this notion of a asset breakdown is something that we absolutely top priority. That's what we want to do with DataSmith, you know, this ability to kind of automate to the maximum. So we're at the level of automation. We think we can get one day to the level of even machine learning and AI, because there are ways to do those things.
Interesting.
You can probably teach someone.
We're just going to use deep learning to solve all our problems now, aren't we?
Not all of them, but you know, it's something when it's based on identifying patterns.
It's
probably relatively prone to that.
Yeah.
By the way, I need to call out the work of Adobe in the space. You know, Stefano Corazza at Adobe with Project Felix. Yeah, they're really showing the way how machine learning can help.
Yeah.
With automated some of the tasks, so it's. It doesn't take over the artist, but it's a real, it's really computer aided.
Absolutely.
You know, the computer is finally aiding.
You pick a background and then it figures out the lighting for you.
Yeah. How cool is that?
That is really cool.
And you still have artistic control and you are directing the piece anyway. It's your work. I don't think it takes anything away from the artist, on the contrary.
It takes away the labor.
It takes away some of the labor. So across all of our industries, I think this is one thing we have in common is, you know, if all of the money and all the attention comes in asset transformation, we're missing the point. The money needs to go into creating something that looks good on the screen, an experience that is people will enjoy experiencing. And that is critical. And that's why I think we don't see as much previous in virtual production as we should be, because it remains kind of an expensive discipline in and of itself.
Well, it's interesting. Okay, here's my take on it, and this is just me, honestly. I think virtual production is a small industry. Obviously, there's only so many movies.
How many stages in the world?
Right, exactly. There's only so many movies out there, et cetera, et cetera. But looking at what's going on there will help. Grow if someone built a really great system for virtual production that gets standardized, that can continue into the architecture world. Because what else is virtual production than just really very, very good augmented reality?
Absolutely.
So if you think about it that way, then it's like, oh, now I can put my camera here and I can see this, and you can change everything. So virtual production is. By investing into it in some way, while we need not necessarily get a huge amount of revenue there, I still think that there's going to be some really interesting thoughts that happen down the line that would serve other industries down the line.
Yeah. But so I agree, and I think the reason why I think in architecture things were a little bit simpler than in film.
Yes,
is that you guys, V-Ray is kind of the standard. So where the ground truth is relatively understood. The problem we have in film is everybody has their own lighting model. Even Material X doesn't solve the lighting problem.
Sure.
You have your, you know, you can invent your own BRDF model or whatever. You know, everybody does Cook Torrens too low, but my lobe is better than your lobes.
Right.
I mean, everybody does it slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really an issue for us because we cannot bake down assets against, you know, a moving target so that we reduce the cost of producing assets. You know, taking film assets into VR right now is a painstaking manual process. I mean, we as an industry, we have to mature. If you look at what happened in digital video, things starting to look good when there was no battle of formats, QuickTime versus, you know, but when it was a consumption-driven model,
right,
where the consumption of the assets was driving the creation of the assets. I still believe we're in a creation-driven world right now. It's the tools kind of dictate the formats.
Right.
So, and that's why I think, you know, we're trying with Epic Games and with Unreal Engine to drive some of that is convince people that, you know, they need to think about those real-time assets ahead of time because the value, if you reduce the cost of producing them or if you embed them into your processes, and we do this with car companies, we call this the permanent parallel pipeline. We say every time you check in a CAD asset, we'll give you a recipe or it will run a process that automates the generation of the Unreal assets.
Okay.
So that at every time through the life cycle of the car, you have an Unreal version of it.
Right.
And when you have like embedded this into your processes and it's always available, the value is enormous because you can do collaborative design reviews, you can do presentation materials, you can do marketing, you can do all kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's absolutely critical. We reduce the cost of producing the assets. It's, again, particularly true in the film. So it's easy in architecture, relatively easy in architecture and manufacturing because these are process-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And in architecture, you know, Max V-Ray is a very solid base to start from.
Sure.
In film, we're an industrial production. We struggle because the way the assets are produced, the way that, you know, the look of things, it's the wild, wild west. So we're we need standards. We need open standards. It's important, and we need to be able to, you know, looks and behaviors. We need to be able to transport them. We cannot redefine them at every stage of the pipeline.
It's a classic problem. And I've sort of spoken to Glenn about it a while ago when he was like, you know, every time they do virtual production, I got to start from scratch. And he's like, it'd be nice if we at least started with something that was basis. It's actually what inspired me when I started the WikiHuman project. It was like, every time we get a new data set from WikiHuman, it was like, rebuild the shader from scratch. It's like, why don't we know what the data is. It's the same as last time. It's just a different person. Let's just start with that. And so that's what sort of inspired me to WikiHuman project. But speaking of that, at SIGGRAPH this year, obviously we were seeing Meet Mike, which was put together with you guys and Kim Library and everything else, which was really cool. So that's an interesting research project that you guys are doing. So how you guys... You guys are investing in all kinds of stuff that's giving back to the customer. It's amazing. So how does that come about? Is this sort of part of Tim's philosophy or what's going on there?
100% Tim's philosophy, and Kim Library is also a man of that always needs a challenge. And we know that, you know, you need to solve problems in real life. So, you know, it's kind of obvious if you have a game engine to think that digital humans and, you know, accurate representation of digital human is something you have on your roadmap.
Right.
And so, you know, when Mike showed up and said, I have my data and I'd like to do something, I said, cool, let's do something.
Right.
Because we're all going to learn. So 7 or 8 companies came together. We've learned a lot.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we can, you know, we like the result because it's a good representation. It allowed us to make a lot of progress in our skin rendering.
Yeah.
In terms of
I was talking to Chris about it as well, and he was super happy. He's like, now it's like we finally have a 2-lobe specular in Unreal, and excited about how that's gonna help with skin, you know?
Absolutely.
So that's really, really exciting. And you know, that comes out of that collaboration and all of us talking about
it. We're a dog food company. We like to eat our own dog food. We make our own games, we make, you know, like we want to understand VR, we do Roborecall.
Right.
You know, which, you know, sets a high water mark in VR interaction, and that game is available, and people trust the engine because we've done that.
Right.
We take a lot of chances with immature hardware as well. I mean, we jump on hardware very early, but that's you know, because that's part of the philosophy of Tim is, you know, we kind of want to always guarantee that you give us any piece of hardware, we'll extract maximum juice out of it.
Right.
That's what people expect from Unreal. Is mm-hmm. that the performance will be tuned. The way we do this is like, you know, even if it's not ready, boom, we get on it.
Right.
You know? And that's what allows us to get on stage, you know, with Apple at WWDC with some great looking content mm-hmm. the day they release the content. So, but it is a mindset in terms of engineering where you kind of have to, you know, you have to take risks.
Yeah.
Because you don't, when you start those things, you don't know the kind of investment you're going to do. But that's the price of getting the level of optimization that we get out of the hardware.
Right. The other thing that was interesting that you showed at the user event is some TV shows that are being rendered.
Yeah, Zafari.
Zafari. So it's all done in Unreal.
How cute is that? Celebrating the difference. Well, you have to give credit where credit is due. Zafari is the brainchild of David Dozeretz. He's mm-hmm. He was one of the three guys with George Lucas doing previews on Episode One, uh-huh. Jack film on the ranch a long time ago.
Right, 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 right.
With Dan Gregor and Chris Edwards. So he's one of our, one of the veteran of our industry, very creative guy. He had this project in him for a long time. And it's hard to get a project funded. Mm-hmm. And I think they were led to consider a game engine. It was an interesting meeting of the mind between Digital Dimension, who did work for Ubisoft,
mm-hmm.
and so got a peek over the wall about the games guy, how far the games guy was able to push graphics.
Right.
And then when they meet with David, and David had this wonderful idea, but it's 9 hours of content. Can you imagine?
Wow.
If you go to your bank to borrow money to create a render farm that can deliver 9 hours of animated content in like a year.
Right.
You're asking for a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they're like, said, you know what? We cannot go the traditional way. And Digital Dimension and Louis Simon, they were like, you know what? We've seen those things from Game Engine. Let's go. Let's try it.
Right.
And David was like, you're going to have to deliver, you know, subsurface scattering and ambient occlusion and all those things. And mm-hmm. I want the jungle. The jungle needs to look rich.
Mm-hmm.
And they tested it. It worked out. And now they're producing the content. You know, they've done 3 hours and a half. It's incredible budgets. They don't want to tell us everything about mm-hmm. the budgets, but
you probably only need a couple computers to render.
Just one, you
one computer to render it on.
It changes.
You think about that. That's amazing.
It changes the workflow dramatically. We're talking to the artist there, and it's like, you know, in a show like this, you always have continuity problem, and you know,
sure.
and when you have a very demanding director. So what they do, because it takes 3 hours to render an 11-minute episode, it's 1 second per frame in average.
Okay.
So, but you know, when David requests changes and, you know, they want to change the editorial, they want to change color, they have continuity issues. But then, you know, 3 hours later, you ship an entirely new episode so you can actually review any changes in the context. You're not
right.
looking at those two shots next to each other. And then when you put them back together, it's not working.
Right.
So
right.
the speed that you get or the quality improvement that you get because you're capable of working all the time in context, you're always working on your final product.
Right, right, right.
And it is amazing. So it's one of those few cases where, you know, you can have your cake and eat it too because that speed, you know, and it means a quality improvement as well because
right.
you iterate more. And then no more render farm, you know, a lot less software to purchase. It was very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very proud of them. And when I saw them, but I said, but guys, you know, why did you stop at 1 frame per second? Because there would be so much value if you could say in real time, because you could say, like, I'm going to do games, I'm going to do VR, I'm going to mm-hmm. do AR with the assets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened on stage, you know, when Pierre arrived at SIGGRAPH and told me, hey, look, my laptop, I have 11 minutes running in real time.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a lot of changes because they
Very
were not in the mindset of doing it real time initially.
Right.
And now they did some optimization and they learned a few tricks and now it runs 24 frames per second.
Right, and you can move around it.
And you can move around it and now you open the door of interactive storytelling and mm-hmm. you open the door of AR, VR. So it's really a fascinating moment that, you know, the impact of those, of the, you know,
mm-hmm.
the real time, first on budget and creativity, and then real time means interactivity. So now what am I going to do with this interactivity? Creative, I'm going to create, you know, different story arcs. Can a kid customize a character in the show?
Right.
You know, because our kids, I have kids, I'm sure.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
You know, they don't like something that cannot influence anymore.
Right.
They respect movies, but you know they want a chance. They take things and they make them theirs.
Right.
So I think when we move to real time, whether it's rendering on device or rendering off the cloud,
right,
we can enable that. So it's really a potentially brave new creative world out there to of new products. That's why we showcase Amigo to the Rescue, mm-hmm, from Disney, which is a very good, you know, is nominated for the Emmys. It's a very good benchmark of what you can do. So of course, you know, Disney quality, rich stories, but yet some level of interactivity.
Right.
It's not a game. It's really a story, and where, you know, the kid can interact with Amigo. And it's, I mean, I'm a strong believer in this. I just cannot wait to see what people do with this.
Sure.
I know there will be a lot of product placement this winter.
Sure.
That's fine. It's better than having to watch those videos, you know?
Yeah, I know.
But it's fascinating, the world of Safari. That's what we try to do, the user group, is like come with a number of case studies so that everybody can make their minds, mm-hmm, on the current state of the technology and what it means and, you know, how far are we from real-time production for those things.
Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated. I think it's going to be very interesting to see those new workflows. I think that's the thing that's the most interesting, is that there are going to be a whole bunch of new workflows. And I think that people are walking into this as an unknown and then as an exploratory thing. So it's nice to be sort of part of that. I've got an idea moment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's fascinating. And
It was strange for me, because that stage on which we did that user group, the exact stage where we did the first Sumatra demo from, mm-hmm, XSI, mm-hmm, 18 years ago.
You're right.
And where, you know, we were trying to bring a lot of new things. And I think, you know, the SIGGRAPH, we find the excitement that we had back in the days around, you know, the beginning of big creature movies and so, mm-hmm, on and so forth. You know, when you know you have a lot of problems to fix and you're not exactly sure what is, you know, what people are going to do with it when you fix the problems.
Right.
You know, we didn't see Jurassic Park coming back in the day.
Nope.
And so we're kind of feel at this moment where, you know, interactive content is going to take a new dimension. This, we've been talking about convergence of movies and games forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not hype anymore. It's,
no.
You know, if you look, nobody talks about it anymore, but it's it's happening.
Well, I'm also just interested in it being used for work, you know, like it's not just the games. It's like, it's used for work. It's interactive with a purpose, you know, it's not just for entertainment. It's for decision making in a lot of ways. So I think those are a really fascinating thing. Can you tell me a little bit about Epic in terms of it as a company? Obviously, you got, like you said, you guys make your own games, but you guys make this engine and all of this other stuff. And you've invested a lot of money into creating something really awesome with your enterprise division. But how does that all break down, and how big is a company? Is there any way to describe that?
Sure. So producing game is people intensive.
Right.
So, you know, Epic Games, probably 600 people. But three quarters of them are actually making the games.
Okay.
The engine team is a relatively small team.
Okay.
You know, we've heard from John Riccitiello that he has 1,400 people in Unity.
Okay.
We're a tenth of that.
Right.
It's a very different scale. And again, we're very project driven. We're very hands on. We're very, you know,
mm-hmm,
it's a very specific culture. And I think it's very successful. I mean, for me, joining Epic after having worked all my career at regular software development organization, it was like stepping into a new dimension. I mean, I was in the 3D world before. Now I'm in a different world. it feels very different. And it's relatively efficient. I think it's really about empowering people and the engineers at Epic Games, I've seen a lot of engineers in my career, as I can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
They're really amazing, and they're really encouraged to take the time to do the right thing.
Right.
And that is pretty unique. And because they have to prove, you know, there's always a project that has there to prove what you do, whether it's working on skin, it's Meet Mike, you're working on compositing, it's the human race, you're working this is Fortnite trailer.
Right.
It creates a very specific and very efficient environment, and it's lean and mean, and it's really enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that you guys are, you know, sort of
because of the size, which is not as big as some people might think, you guys really can focus on a lot of sort of interesting things that way. So it's really great.
Yeah, one of the things that just happened was the Disney announcement,
uh-huh.
which brings, I think, all aspects of the problems we're trying to solve
mm-hmm.
to bear. So we're enterprise, we're game company. You know, look at Disney, what do? They do linear stuff.
Right.
They do nonlinear interactive stuff.
Yep.
They have Imagineering.
Yep.
That does. There's architecture, there's manufacturing, and we've been given a great opportunity to step inside the minds of all of those people and, you know, figure out how this new technology is going to transform their processes.
It's a good point. So
you should probably tell the listeners about the Disney announcement.
Yeah, so what Ken refers to is we were selected in the Disney Accelerator, which mm-hmm. is usually a structure to help startup get a chance, to understand, you know, a company like Disney so that they can fine-tune their product offering.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as a gigantic brainstorming opportunity.
Right.
And we were invited as a 25-year-old, 600-strong, you know, startup. Mm-hmm. Into this accelerator because I think Disney and Epic recognize that we touch a lot of their businesses,
right?
Whether it's television, you know, Imagineering, cruises, hotels, you know, we have a lot of it. And it was interesting to kind of create that collision
mm-hmm.
between the two companies to create brainstorm. Nobody knows where this is going to go, but it's been a fascinating voyage of discovery because it's scary about the amount of things. Or the need for digital content and particularly interactive digital content,
mm-hmm.
And how crucial it is now to enterprises.
Right.
If you create movies, of course, but everywhere we turn, we see people from the industry, from all industry, understanding the value of content in the enterprise.
Right.
And who knows how to create content at scale? We know.
Right.
We, the media entertainment, with the film and the games people.
Yep.
We know that there is no, and there is an appetite for a lot of companies to learn. But when you are a small organization like Epic Games and you visualize, you get close to the beast and you visualize the magnitude of the opportunity, that's a bit scary.
Right.
Because but on the other hand, it's very reassuring because, you know, it's you know, the stuff we do is interesting and important and can really help.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the divisions at Disney. So that's a very interesting experience.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really cool. Like I said, I'm think that there's I can't wait to find out what other people are doing with it. You know, it's like it's almost like we made this thing,
gave it away for free,
and then like
we're still discovering our customers. They keep popping up left and right.
I know. Well, you and I have been emailing each other. It's like yep. There's another. that yes. We could work on together. So there's a lot of those things that
drug discovery.
Yeah, it's true.
AI, we're training Skynet with Unreal Engine. A lot of people are training AI agents with Unreal Engine. We've discovered a lot of usage.
I know the auto driving stuff you guys showed was amazing.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, instead of having a car drive all over the place, have it drive in virtual world all over the place and learn that way.
Yeah, and you know, it's agents get trained by. So Unreal Engine is kind of the eyes of the AI machine,
right?
Because they use, you know, a lot of companies use Unreal Engine to teach machines about the real world,
right?
Whether it's for cars, but there's a lot of other agents. You know, it's about spatial navigation, but it's also about logic.
Mm-hmm.
They use games, so we don't know the details, unfortunately. And maybe I'm not sure I want to know everything about that.
Sure.
It's somewhat very scary.
Yeah,
but we know. Or we guess that some companies, you know, build games basically to teach software agents how to think.
Mm-hmm.
So that was totally unexpected for me. And how pervasive that is. I mean, it's a lot of companies, sometimes we have a hard time figuring it out because they don't need to talk to us.
Right.
You know, you go on the internet, you give me first name, last name, a fake email address, I give you my source code.
Right.
And so that is very interesting. The other aspect also that was a little bit surprising is, as AI makes a lot of machinery more complex, like cars, mm-hmm. There is appetite for the language and the technology of video games. So we have a lot of opportunities and we're working on a lot of projects around embedded systems for HMI, particularly in cars and other devices where It's something like Unreal Engine with state machines. You know, it's the right and graphics. You know, as long as you have an embedded GPU of some strengths, but you know, we run on any mobile device, so right. we run on a wide variety of hardware. But people create some really interesting UI using the engine in embedded systems. So the whole topic of HMI and user experiences is so much more software now in any objects. It's right. a whole green field for us that we're starting to be pulled into. That's, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes we think we'd like to focus on one or two things, but we get pulled into so many, so many different things. So it's interesting. So, you know, it's also for students out there, for people that want to make a career in computer graphics. I mean, you don't know where this is going to take you.
Right.
You know, you think you go to school and you study games, or you go to architectural school and you study architecture and everything, and you can find yourself doing all kind of things that could change the world.
Yeah.
Using those tools, but not applied to the original intent. You know.
Those are the best tools. The tools that emerge out of a different use case, I think, are the most interesting ones, you know. So definitely pretty cool. Well, we're just about at an hour, and I know that you and I and we all need to get
ready. We have a cigarette to finish.
Yes. We have a cigarette to finish, and there's a dinner we're coming up. So anyway, I really appreciate your time, and thanks so much for doing this, and so exciting. I'm sure I'd love to hear from, and for the listeners listening, please, if you guys have ideas, send them our way, and we would love to hear about them.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was a great
moment. Thanks, guys.